Frank, I'd further like to explain, George Getz is with the Times, and is I'm with the Times, so just to explain the technique of news gathering, our organization is so far flung these days that we are each going out in our separate ways, and quite likely George will, if he does not write a daily story on this afternoon session, he will pass that material on to me, whether he does or not, he'll pass the material on to me, and because I have specialized in this area as well, and then I'll put it in a manila folder, and I've got a technique now. I've got a system of manila folders, and I watch how fat they get, and when they reach a certain width, then I know it's time to write a what we call a think piece, and I'll take it out and try to amplify it and do an analytical piece, and I will go to Rand Corporation. I will go to Caltech as well as to industry people. I feel that if we're talking about credibility, if a story is written purely from the point of view of the industry without some sort of evaluation by people outside of the industry, the public simply won't believe it.
I would like to add one thing, sort of as a non-media man. And I think my problem has been over the years with this type of panel is deciding which expert to pick and which expert to quote. I can think today of a fuel study which is being talked about in most of your societies, and by one of the major industry spokesmen, ex-portfolio, which shows that we have no fossil fuel reserves beyond about 30 years, and that at the present rate of use, even our coal reserves will be exhausted too soon to be feasibly acceptable. I can quote equally prestigious expert from an equally large company, an equal spokesman for the industry, who shows quite the contrary, that the fossil fuel resources of the world will not only last relatively indefinitely, but will constantly decline in cost. So I have a little problem in deciding which expert is the expert. And I think this was what confuses the public so, is that we have many, many experts saying many, many things. I was once told by my engineering economics prof something I think applies, and he said, look, son, he said, if all economists were laid end to end, they would all point in different directions.
We have a question back here in the center.
I'm Les Barry, a Western editor of Transmission and Distribution, which is another trade magazine in the industry. Prior to becoming an editor, I was a working engineer for some 40 years, so I have seen some of the problems from both sides of the fence. And it may seem strange that an editor is going to start defending the electric utility industry for a couple of minutes. As an observation, it is a young industry. And for certainly 40 to 50 years of the history of the industry, nothing happened to the rate structure except that it went down and down and down. There were nothing but rate reductions. I was privileged to sit in a meeting some 8 years ago, which is not very long ago, and considering when inflation started, Commonwealth Edison in Chicago, increasing labor rates and so on, made it necessary for them to think about applying for a rate increase. Within the living memory of all of the officials of that company, no one had remembered when they had ever applied for a rate increase, and they didn't know how to go about doing it. That's an objective statement. With LADWP now paying, I think, 400% more for fuel oil than they paid last year, I think somebody has to admit that it's about time the rates went up. And I guess I could only suggest that maybe Tom Harris ought to sit with PG&E for a couple of months and look into rate structures. It's a very complex thing. Public utility commissions have a little something to say about it. And I think it might then be well for Tom Harris to say that I have been there, I have looked into it, and yeah, we really ought to have a rate increase. Con Edison was mentioned earlier, and I spend a lot of time in New York, although I live in the Bay Area. I was kind of shaken with what happened to Con Edison after the Northeastern blackout. I don't think there's a single individual outside of Con Edison in New York that doesn't sincerely believe that Con Edison caused the Northeast blackout. The plain facts are the problem that caused the Northeast blackout started in Canada with a maladjusted relay. Because of the requirements of the Northeast blackout, Con Edison stayed on the line and literally, with the most to lose, went down with the ship. They did not separate their breakers or cut loose from the Northeastern intertie, the power group. As a result of that, they lost their largest machine and their second and third largest turbine generators. This is like the Queen Mary losing all of her engines and being left with an oar. In spite of that, the service to New York was restored in 9 hours after that kind of a catastrophe. I don't think that the newspapers or anyone else ever gave Con Edison credit for that kind of a job. People in New York shortly afterwards were wearing buttons, stamp out Con Edison. The ecologists have prevented them from building a pump storage hydro plant up the Hudson. And I don't know how you go about dramatizing this kind of fact. I think Jim Foy has probably given the industry the best advice that we've had tonight, but I don't know how you write catch headlines for these kinds of facts when the media, comedians, and everyone else are running down Con Edison for what really was a magnificent job under the circumstances.
Let me respond to the non-question of the responder. I think it's got to be clearly understood. You know, if we can't come out of this evening's thing without a clear understanding of what was said, there's very little likelihood that you'll be able to convey to your people or me to mine what was said. And I want it clearly understood for my purposes that I have never suggested that this was not the time for a rate increase. Heaven knows we've had about 18 of them in a row in the past 11 months in my area. That would Harry Bain will shoot me, maybe not that many. But we've had a good many rate increases. And while I am one who believes that there is enough fossil fuel with sensible consumption patterns to last this country a good many hundreds of years, I do not believe, as I have said earlier tonight, that we'll ever see the price of energy as low as it is now or as low as it has been. I'll take your suggestion. I think it's an excellent one that I spend a lot more time becoming more acquainted with the rate structure business. I have spent some time. I think a point needs to be made here about the kind of problem the media is up against and what role we are supposed to fulfill here. If you want us to do what the high school science teachers couldn't do and what your college professors couldn't do, that is to educate the people about scientific facts, you're going to have to give us a lot of time. One of the other things you're going to have to do is you're going to have to convince our publishers that that's a necessity. And perhaps Larry's remarks earlier about ombudsmen for newspapers is not at all far-fetched and perhaps as long overdue as a trend. One of the difficulties that I perceive in our field is that we don't get enough feedback from people in the community. There's a very defensive attitude on the part of, well, for purposes of tonight, we're talking about you people, and it applies here, it applies to many others. You feel that criticism is something that you ought not to do. People harpoon you from a distance, and you stay in your corporate shell. And then 3 or 4 months later, we'll see a full-page color advertising campaign across the country. I think there has to be more communication with the people who run and own the media. You don't have to come on strong if you're afraid of the response, but I think somebody's got to hear from you. You think more work has to be done in this field, which is a long way of saying I'm not sure any one person can be an environment/energy writer and do the job for either. So what we need is more of a commitment on our part. And while I react somewhat defensively to charges that we don't do it well, I do admit that we don't do it as well as we ought to because we don't get enough community pressure to do the job well. I think that we're reporting out of date and old fashions, and we haven't really got around to intensive presentation of these complex issues, even though we spend many more hundreds of inches on them now every week than we ever did before. I don't think it's enough. So just some reactions to your reactions, I guess.
All right. Thank you. Larry?
Thank you. I also, in that statement, I detected an assumption there that those of us who write about utilities and rate increases have not talked to the utilities about the necessity for rate increases. On the contrary, not only have we had long conversations with the utility companies, but we have read all of the filings, I've read volume after volume of filings on rate increases. And I've got the calluses in my rear end from sitting through PUC hearings that will guarantee that I've been sitting side by side with many of the people I see out in the audience through rate increase hearings. And I think that the assumption that we just somehow sort of glide in for a few minutes and pick up a press release or make a snap judgment and walk out is not warranted.
All right, we have another question. I think about one more, and we're all right.
Jim Dickinson, PG&E. Since I'm an engineer, I think I'll take advantage of Mr. Foy's suggestion and practice a little insulting, or at least pose a semi-insulting question.
And he's bigger than I am, too. Isn't that awful?
Actually, it's not addressed to you. Some time ago, I was doing some reading, specifically T.H. White's last book on the making of the president. He drew an analogy in that book between various groups of reporters working for competing papers and stables of racehorses. The scoop for the big story is analogous or equivalent to winning the race. Now, Mr. White, being a highly recognized member of the media, assuming his assessment is correct, I'd like to ask Mr. Harris and Mr. Pryor to respond to the following question. How can the utility industry really feel comfortable relaying information to the press for their relay in turn to the public, given this atmosphere which pervades most of the papers? It would be, at least in my way of viewing it, somewhat questionable whether it would reach the public in the same form that we intended it when we gave it.
Well, let me jump in first, Larry. To start at the back and work forward, I'm sure that it won't reach the public in the same form that you gave it to us in. That's not our function. As Larry indicated earlier, our job is to get something and then take in all the variety of points of views there are. Going to the heart of the question, whether or not, well, I won't say whether or not, I don't agree with the assumption that all newspaper stories are written from the standpoint of you know, to the most explosive goes the race, the quickest there with the catchiest headline. I do acknowledge that in areas where there is intense inter-city competition between newspapers, people who put out front pages and have to put street headlines on them are want to look for a story that's got a hot handle so that it will sell more papers. I, of course, don't deny that. But the majority of papers in the country today, particularly out here, have such a tremendous base of home circulation newspapers that street sales don't make that much of a difference. And if they don't make that much, if I'm accurate that they don't make that much of a difference, then the presumption is inaccurate that we write only for that reason. It happens occasionally, and that's all. I think the majority of reports of stories that are reported are reported in depth, probably not the depth that other people would like to see them. But I don't think that's the case. Certainly, if it were, you wouldn't feel very comfortable about it. But you pay your nickel and take your chances. And if you feel that's, I think you're wrong, but if you feel you're right, the thing for you to do is go to the newspaper's executives and say, now listen, you know, here was the way the issue was presented, and this is the kind of treatment we got, and we think it was unfair. As I've mentioned earlier, there hasn't been enough of that. We need checks and balances, too, and there has been very, very little of that kind of check and balance from the general public or from any of the institutions or companies within it.
I'd like to amplify on that. As I said earlier, I think that there's room for both of us to reform, and I think your point is well taken, and I think that it gets back to this question of accountability. And I think we should realize that I think it's a paradoxical situation that that investor-owned utilities and newspapers that are owned by publishers who are also beholden to stockholders and boards of directors are in very similar positions. We're performing public functions, and yet we are privately owned. And I think that what needs to be done here on both sides is that we have to increase our accountability to the public. And I think that it is incumbent on you as an industry to come to the media and demand accountability. I think that you should come and demand that we have some mechanism for correcting errors, that we have an ombudsman who will go to reporters who write distorted stories and examine how this story got in the paper and whether it really was fair or not. There are professional standards that our work can be judged against now. We have journalism reviews that are developing just as law reviews developed. We're a long way from being professionals, in my opinion, but we're getting there. And I think that if people who are professionals, such as you are, professional engineers and accomplished businessmen would come to us and put the heat on us, I think our publishers would make us more accountable. But at the same time, I think that you also should become more accountable to the public, and that was the message I was trying to get across.
May I align myself in this case with my colleagues from the media? And I hope I'm not practicing the art of insult either, but I think it is presumptuous to assume that the role of the media is to transmit your intent to the public. The role of the media is to take your inputs, to assess and evaluate them, and to pass that on to the public, being sure that the facts, however, are accurate, and so we are accountable in that way. I've had many cases of people calling me from the West Coast early in the morning to change the tense of a verb when I'm busily cutting 50% of the material out of his manuscript. People misunderstand the function of the press. It is not to be the transmitter of your information the way you want it transmitted.
Thank you. I think at this point we'll close the session and the questions. As I began my comments, we are in an arena of confrontation. We have been in such an arena for many, many years. That arena includes emotions, and those emotions run away. We fight against people's emotions and their reactions. We need to do our homework on how to communicate. We get that from the message tonight. We need to do our homework on how to relate to the media. We need to learn how to pass information on to the media. And if they don't use that information as it should be used, honestly, straightforwardly, then we must take action that actually demands that they make use of it properly. And this is what the point is just made here. The comment is made about a social conscience being in the industry. I think if you examine the history of the electric utility industry, you'll find that a social conscience has pervaded the industry. There are few industries that have the dedication to service that are a part of the electric utility industry. We're looking for ways that we can relate to the customers that we serve, give them honest, straightforward answers, expect them to recognize us as people of integrity, of goodwill. The media is a part of helping us affect that kind of communications. We've got a job to do of learning how to work with them and with them on how to work with us. Now, with that, I'll turn the session back over to George Davis. Thank you.
Well, it's been a long, long evening. And Frank, Ed, Bill, Jim, Tom, Larry, thank you for being aboard, taking the time. I understand you will be around a little bit to talk to some of the people who have further questions. Now, what did I hear tonight? I think we had some trouble staying on the track about how we could close the credibility gap between those guys and us guys, as we call ourselves. We had heard a lot more statements than questions and answers. We did find out some strong points and views. We did pick up a few how-to-dos about closing this credibility gap, and we need to pick up a lot more. I think we need to have a lot more of these kinds of meetings. Now, Monday, we go back to the real world, and I think I can figure out a few challenges for engineers from our friend Jim. Maybe we can work on those. Tomorrow, Students' Day, student luncheon. We hope you can be aboard and meet the students. Tomorrow night, our Mexican fiesta. We like to have you all come out and share in our local heritage. John, do you have anything else? Okay. Thanks a lot. We'll see you tomorrow. Drive carefully on your way to your room. We're adjourned.
Thank you.